This is How Success Happens, where the staff of Entrepreneur chats with innovators, writers, artists, chefs, and a range of other unique personalities to better understand the traits that make excellence possible.
Nobody in Silicon Valley thinks it's actually them. They think everybody else is like this.
One of my regrets actually now, we should have pulled the plug sooner.
It's amazing when the universe sees you commit, how all of a sudden all these resources start to come together.
Thanks for joining us. And now, How Success Happens.
Hey there, Hayden Field here, Associate Editor at Entrepreneur. I'm here with Doug Lina, monk turned financial advisor. In his 20 years as a monk, Doug saw financial suffering firsthand in his teaching community, in the monastery's guests, and even in his monastery itself. He decided to take a leap and pivot to a career as a financial advisor. After helping turn the monastery's finances around and pull the community out of bankruptcy, he started a financial services company and wrote a book called From Monk to Money Manager, A Former Monk's Financial Guide to Becoming a Little Bit Wealthy and Why That's Okay. Lynam aims to help people learn mindful money management and provide clear step-by-step guidance on how to grow a little bit wealthy.
We'll talk about that and more in just a minute after a word from our sponsors.
This podcast is brought to you by ClearBank. ClearBank is changing the way entrepreneurs raise money with equity-free capital. Founders shouldn't give up a piece of their company to fund marketing and inventory expenses. ClearBank makes equity-free investments from $10,000 to $10 million. They charge a small flat fee for the capital, and you pay them back using a win-win revenue share. This is not a loan. There's no interest rate, no fixed maturation date, no personal guarantees, no credit checks, and no financial covenants. ClearBank has invested over $150 million in 2018 and is on track to invest over $1 billion this year. So if you're doing over $10,000 a month in revenue, find out how you can receive ClearBank capital by getting your 20-minute term sheet at clearbank.com/HSH. That's clear, B-A-N-C, bank with a C, .com/HSH. clearbank.com/HSH. ClearBank, stop pitching and get back to doing what you love, growing your business. So Doug, you spent 20 years as a monk, and I know you witnessed a lot of financial suffering at both your monastery and in the community. Was there one case in particular, one moment that made you act on your idea to take the leap and pivot to financial advising?
Yeah, there actually was. There was one situation where a friend and a colleague had come to me for some financial help, and I think this was around 2008, right during the financial crisis, and she hadn't done a very good job of preparing for her retirement. And she asked if I would give her some tips and some planning advice. And I said, of course. And we sat down one afternoon and opened up her retirement account. And after 30 years of teaching, she only had $16,000 saved. And she had a lot of credit card debt on top of that. And to see the emotional struggles that she went through, just to see what a sort of financial train wreck she was facing and how she was unable to retire at that point when she wanted to and kind of needed to, really kicked me into high gear and realized that there was a real need in the community that I was in for good financial advice. And there was obviously something missing from the whole financial system, particularly in the 403B or the retirement plan space where I work primarily, to offer better advice and to build better retirement plans for folks. And when I dug deeper into the program, to the retirement plan at the school where I worked, I realized that there were huge systemic flaws in that plan, and that those flaws were in almost every school I could find around the country. And it wasn't unique to me. It wasn't unique to her. It was actually almost all teachers across the country face a problem of not having an adequate retirement plan. It isn't that they aren't putting enough money in. They're actually sometimes even putting plenty of money in. The plan design is flawed. There's high fees, bad investments, bad plan architecture. And it really opened my eyes to how much what tremendous suffering was or the result of these very, very poorly designed retirement plans, but then also a huge business opportunity, right? So if you can see a problem in the world and you see some suffering and you can find a solution, that's going to be a marketable business opportunity. And I was like, wow. And I also had, of course, the monk thing behind me and developed a pretty significant skill set around financial planning. And it just seemed like a great marketing opportunity as well. And I just took the leap. And so that's where I started.
When you had that conversation, that was in 2008, mm-hmm. and you left the monastery in 2016 to start mm-hmm. your company, right?
Correct.
What did you do in between? You know, did you start kind of just bootstrapping it during those 8 years and then finally take the plunge and go into financial advising full time in 2016?
Well, the first thing I had to do was get a lot of certifications and credentials. You can't just jump into the industry even if you want to, right?
Of course.
There's a lot of licensures that you need. So it took me a while to get all those, pass all the exams and get all of the certifications to give myself the qualifications to do the job right. And then it took a long time to actually nail my solution, right? So if you're an entrepreneur, there's a wonderful book out, I'm sure it's pretty popular with your listeners. It's called Nail It, Then Scale It. And that was really helpful for me to understand how to be an entrepreneur and how you first have to nail your solution, test it out in a small market, really hammer that solution, and then scale it out. So really that 8 years was spent just refining that solution, really nailing it, getting my first clients and making sure my solution worked and making sure I had a solution that was scalable on a large scale, which finance is one of the most complicated and legally technical industries out there. So I had to navigate a very difficult bureaucracy and really make sure I had my mind around all of the legal angles within the industry to be sure that I could then really make sure my solution would be robust and would hold up under scrutiny and under all kinds of different scenarios. And then, I mean, scaling is really a very difficult task. So you need to have the infrastructure in place. That was a really tricky piece for me, and it took a while to figure it out. But eventually, I did.
What's broken as far as the way most people think about money right now, in your opinion? And how did your time as a monk inspire you to think about money differently?
Well, there's so many things that are broken about money. I'm not sure where to start. But I would say one thing that really intrigued me was how could I, as a monk, as someone who cares deeply about living a spiritual and ethical life, be in the world of finance, which is traditionally viewed as somewhat sleazy, right? It has a reputation for a lot of abuse and a lot of greed and quite a bit of corruption. And how could I enter into that world and still maintain my ethical integrity? And how could I be building wealth for myself personally and building wealth for my clients and do it in an ethical and manner that I think had integrity, right? But to do that, I had to go back and look at a lot of my attitudes around money. And we have a lot of, I think, collective and societal baggage around money, a lot of shame, a lot of guilt. And there's reasons for that. And I think one of the things that's maybe broken in some of our understandings about how money works is that a lot of the philosophy and theology and core beliefs we have around money date to a pre-modern era. So if you look back at the Bible, or you look back at Socrates or Seneca, or the great philosophers, right, they'll frequently admonish people against the dangers of money, and they have their points to make, and they're valid. However, they're living in a pre-modern time. They didn't have a rule of law. They didn't have democracy. The idea of a business, the idea of a corporation hadn't been invented yet. The middle class would not be invented for another 1,600 years after Jesus preached and taught. So he was living in a world where wealth was mostly zero sum. So where one person's wealth comes at the expense of others, where you have to oppress or actually enslave and kill people in the old days. It was more like Spartacus, right? This was sort of the era that a lot of these philosophers were writing in. And that's not the case. In a modern economy, building wealth is no longer zero sum. It can be a win-win where everybody's better off. And so instead of seeing wealth as the problem, which some people nowadays are doing, I think it's better to reframe it and see that poverty is the problem. We don't want to get mad at people for building wealth. We want to look at poverty as something to be cured and solved through the power of economics and personal finance, which can do that. And I believe that capitalism and free markets are the most powerful tool for eradicating poverty that we've ever discovered in the history of human civilization. And the data proves that point. In the past 20 years alone, capitalism has pulled over 1 billion people out of extreme poverty. And that's, I think, a miracle worth celebrating. So if we can look at those attitudes and those beliefs and find a healthier way forward, in from monk to money manager, that's really what I'm exploring, at least for the first part. And then we get into the nuts and bolts of financial planning for the second part. But I think that's really helpful for me to have explored that and offer some solutions.
I think there are a lot of attitudes of guilt around money, especially today, and building wealth in general. And I think I recently read a book by Jen Sincero in which she talked about...
And she's a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I was hanging out this last weekend.
She's great. We did a piece on her a few months ago, and she was great. But yeah, she explored, of course, the idea of that we all feel guilty about wanting to build wealth and wanting to be financially secure, and that we need to take that guilt away or else we're never going to get to that point. Mm-hmm. Do you think that guilt is a pretty big deterrent in people reaching their financial goals? And how can we overcome that when, like you were mentioning, our feelings about money are drilled into us from a very young age?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they were drilled into me from a young age. And I still feel guilty sometimes about making money and trying to become wealthier and wealthier. But I also, because that's my money baggage, right? I think we all need to explore that very carefully and try to realize where they come from, where those attitudes and beliefs reside. And then to understand that by being mindful about the power of wealth and to realize that money is not the root of all evil. Money is the root of everything, good and evil. So how can you and I and others make it serve the good? And From Monk to Money Manager, I think, takes that head on and offers some really compelling solutions in that regard. But you're going to have to dig into why you feel guilty about money. And I think part of it goes back to that zero-sum thinking, is the idea that somehow, if I'm wealthy, I've made someone else poor, and I should feel guilty about that. That's absolutely incorrect. That building wealth can be a win-win all around, especially if you're building your wealth ethically and investing sustainably, and so my field of expertise is, you know, money management and investments. And what we've discovered over the past 15 years is that environmentally and socially responsible investments are now outperforming conventional investments. And so we can actually build a better world through our investment practices while growing wealthier than we would if we sort of ignored those social considerations. So then everybody wins. And I think that's something to celebrate.
Definitely. I think that's a really good point too, because let's think about the typical, maybe a typical employee right now, maybe even some of my coworkers and I. We invest in our company 401k, don't really know which companies each fund is really investing in. I feel like I'm a little dialed in that I chose my different, which fund worked best for me based on, you know, target retirement account, things like that, target date retirement fund, things like that. But if you're a typical employee now, you just chose a fund, you don't really know where the money is going in there. What's the first step towards figuring out whether you're ethically investing and whether your investments currently align with your morals and values?
Well, that's a great question, but it's a very hard one to answer because it depends on your retirement plan and what your investment choices are. So without knowing exactly what choices you have in your particular plan, it's very hard to figure that out. So what I've done at Longview Asset Management in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I work, is we've built the first all environmentally and socially responsible retirement plan for a school, the first one of its kind. So all the default investment choices are all environmentally and socially responsible. But the sad reality, and I'm afraid the truth of it, of the matter, is that I would say over 90% of 401k and 403b plans out there have no socially responsible options. So to invest with your values is really hard if the plan isn't designed to allow that possibility. And the only way to fix that is to have someone else come in and rejigger your investment options and demand them. And it's not that hard to change. I think part of the problem is that people aren't standing up and asking for change and asking for those investments. And if you go to your business office, your human resources director, and say, hey, what are my socially responsible investment options? And if they throw their hands up and say, I don't know, or they don't give you a satisfactory answer, then you should be demanding that those options become available. And if enough employees step up and ask for them, they can add them pretty easily. It's not a technically difficult thing to do, but if there's no pressure on them, then they don't feel a compelling reason to do it.
How can you look at, let's say, you know, you're investing in a typical fund that pulls in a lot of different pieces. Mm-hmm. How can you educate yourself about what those pieces are and whether they're ethical or environmentally sustainable? Do you just look up the fund name and figure out what each little piece is going towards? Or do you really need to talk to the investment manager and call them up and say, okay, explain every aspect of this fund to me and where my money is going?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer because, well, maybe the simplest thing is typically there's your plan design will either highlight the environmentally responsible options or you can look at the name. What you're looking for, the key letters are ESG, right? So environmental, social, and governance, ESG, are the criteria that sort of dictate responsible investing. And most of the ESG funds have those letters in the name. So if you see that somewhere, or sometimes it's called SRI, which is socially responsible investing, or sustainable investing. If you're seeing those words in the name of the fund, chances are pretty good. Well, certainly you know those are going to be ones to drill down deeper into and take a look at. But if you're really confused, every retirement plan should have what's called a fiduciary, right? There should be somebody in charge of it or someone you can call up, an 800 number, a service number that you can call and to ask those very questions. And your customer service rep should be able to very quickly guide you to the right choices without you having to do a lot of legwork, because that's just too much to ask. To do a deep dive into the actual individual stocks that the funds are investing is far too technical work to ask of a typical employee. But whoever is running it, whoever your customer service reps are, call your 800 number. They should be able to tell you answer those questions for you very quickly.
Right. And you shouldn't be afraid to ask, right? I mean, right. I used to be a financial reporter and my boss always said, call and have them repeat it until you understand. Because, I mean, that's their job. Even if you're just a typical employee who your only investment is in maybe your retirement account, it's a great goal to be able to understand where your dollars are going.
Yeah, I think it's key.
I also think in recent years, the wants versus needs money management strategy has come under fire. So as someone who practices mindful money management, what's your take on that?
Well, I guess I would ask you to clarify, how do you see wants versus needs? And what context are you referring to that?
Well, I think that's the reason it's come under fire. A lot of people say, okay, you know, a coffee every day is a want. This amount of groceries is a need. Mm-hmm. But some people say, oh, well, getting coffee every morning brings me a lot of joy. It helps me get ready for my day. It's a ritual that turns my brain from home to work, mm-hmm. things like that. So I think that's why it's come under fire. It's very subjective.
It is.
And so I also think there's a lot of guilt associated with that. So how can you determine, I guess, what's your number one strategy for practicing money management mindfully from going from these black and white rules that have been established just from different people's opinions over time and figuring out what's right for you?
Well, I think the first step is always to pay yourself first, to set your savings goal and your investment goals come as your number one priority and to make it automatic. So if you can automatically withdraw your investments and savings from your paycheck every week or every month, whenever your money comes in, you're just skimming it right off the top and making sure you're investing that wisely and ethically, then hopefully you've built a constructive budget around which you can work. And then I think you can use your money in a way that gives you as much satisfaction and pleasure as appropriate for you, given your values. I actually don't spend a lot of time on worrying about whether this latte is a good purchase or bad purchase. Like if I'm enjoying it and I have the money and it's in my budget, I'm just going for it because I know I've already saved what I need to save and that my discretionary spending is exactly that. It's at my discretion, whatever my whim at this moment is, and as long as I don't exceed that budget allowance, I'm good to go. So to figure out how much you want to allocate for your discretionary spending and then enjoy it and live it. And the bigger that pot of cash you can make that be after you've already done your savings, go for it, I say.
Let's say you're an entrepreneur who has a business idea and you haven't started working towards it yet. You want to start budgeting. You want to make sure you know where all your money is going and that you have enough for your goals. Mm-hmm. What strategies would you recommend using for getting started on that path, for tracking where your dollars are going, mm-hmm. for making sure you're setting aside enough for your eventual business, for getting all of this into focus and really taking control of your journey?
Yeah, that's the hard step. Of course, getting started as an entrepreneur is the most difficult step. That's where things are most likely to fall apart because you're in a very fragile state financially and your business idea is still untested. So you need to make sure you're really on solid financial ground. And bookkeeping, unfortunately, which is what everyone hates to do, is going to be key to that. There's excellent software programs out there. You know, any of the big names work well. I don't necessarily have a preference of one over the other. But to make sure that you really get to be a good bookkeeper, if you can track what's coming in, what's going out very carefully. And then I would say that the most important step is to make sure you have enough cash reserves to weather the inevitable slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that are going to come your way in the first few years of starting your business idea. If you've got that little pot of cash that you can store up and give yourself that emergency fund for your business that's separate from your personal emergency fund, that's going to really help you stay afloat when times get tough.
Let's talk about your book title, A Little Bit Wealthy. What exactly do you mean by that? And why is that a good goal to have?
Well, I think part of it is to take away the guilt so you can be a little bit wealthy and you can be a lot wealthy. But I think the title is really kind of a hook to help people understand that a little bit wealthy is necessary for everyone. You cannot escape the journey to becoming a little bit wealthy, because that's what's going to allow you to pay for your healthcare. That's going to let you put a roof over your head. That's going to let you retire with some dignity, send your kids to college, pay for all the living expenses and day-to-day things that you need. And if you don't have a little bit of wealth, what I found through personal experience and through what I see in my clients is you are going to set yourself up for an incredible amount of suffering. And there's no reason for that to happen if you can avoid it. So if I can help clients and I can help you avoid the pain that comes from poverty, then I feel like I've done something really good in the world. There's an interesting statistic from the, I believe it's the Journal of Consumer Research, just did a report, and they found out that the quality of your financial life, your financial stability, has a bigger impact on your mental health than your physical health, your job satisfaction, and your relationship stability combined. So if you don't have a little bit of wealth, if you don't have a steady financial foundation, your life is going to be filled with pain, a lot of it. So that's why I think everyone needs to make that journey to becoming a little bit wealthy, and why it's such a pleasure and a joy for me to help others on that journey and that process.
What does financial freedom mean to you exactly? And do you think the definition is different for an entrepreneur taking a big risk for their big idea?
Yeah. So for me, what it means is that each day is filled with activities that align with my values. So what do I value doing? I value building my business. I value spending time with friends, enjoy working out. I enjoy cooking. These are the things that I value. And so money and wealth allow me to pursue those values and live my life to the fullest extent possible. Now, if you don't have a strong financial foundation, then what happens, I think, is you get pushed around and end up doing a lot of things to survive. You're in survival mode. And so you may value the paycheck and you may value the income from a job, but the work itself may not be intrinsically meaningful for you. So for me, having wealth means that my work efforts, my career, my family, and my free time are all in alignment towards the things that I find important and meaningful without being pushed around arbitrarily by the need to just get the bills paid this week or this month. And then ultimately to the point where you can work or not work. It's your choice. That's sort of the ultimate definition of financial freedom. And for an entrepreneur, well, it really depends on what your business is, I think. But I would say the simplest on the bottom level of financial freedom for an entrepreneur would be when your business is self-sustaining and self-sufficient. And you can either be a part of it or not, but it's generating you, hopefully a passive income would be great, or even an active income. But that's your focus in your life, and that's able to support you and your family without lots of side hustles.
You starting a business as an entrepreneur and you becoming a financial advisor and learning about money management. What's the single biggest lesson you learned from your time at the monastery that you carried over into becoming an entrepreneur and to your money management strategies today?
Well, the simplest one is sort of obvious, but is that if you ever ignore money at any point in your life, it's going to kick you in the backside. This is something we all need to deal with. We all have to come to grips with it. So we might as well find a way to deal with it with as much grace and dignity as possible. Because if you try to ignore it, avoid it, or maybe to be blunt, there's nowhere you can escape to in this world where money isn't going to be an issue. Even in a monastery, even taking a vow of poverty, I couldn't escape it. I tried. I really did. And it didn't work. So now, how are you going to face this reality with as much dignity as you can?
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it a lot.
That's our episode. We hope you enjoyed it. How Success Happens comes out every week. To catch each episode, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Like, share, and leave us a review so we can always be improving. Go to entrepreneur.com for more episodes of this show and our other great podcasts. That's entrepreneur.com. Thanks.